Well, from Stevie Wonder to Brewocracy, now here on KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, now is your chance to speak with John Morrow, Port Townsend City Manager. We do this every week as spreading a bit of knowledge about what's going on in our town, a bit of rumor control, and everything in between. Welcome, John.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. Enjoying the sunshine.
Yeah. Well, first, before I go any further, I want to thank Phil Andrus for filling in for me. I'm just lucky to have somebody like Phil that can sit in this seat and speak to you. Along with all the other things he does here at KPTZ.
Yes, that was fun. Thank you, Phil. I bet you're listening, and I appreciate the rapid fire questions. I think it kept me on my toes, and I appreciate that.
Well, speaking of being on your toes, I understand we have some questions from a listener, and maybe we would like to start there.
Yeah, indeed, we do. And I want to give it up for Carla, who took some time to write. So I'll start with that one first. And maybe it probably doesn't need a paraphrase because it's a relatively short question. But Carla said that she listened to the City Council Infrastructure Committee meeting this week and appreciated the discussion. I understand that the city is not a housing developer, but is responsible for our infrastructure. Can you describe the process you all went through to create this new committee and the scope of its future work as it relates to our housing crisis? And then she takes the time to say thank you. So Carla, thank you so much. I'm glad that folks are watching that new committee. Interestingly, I just rolled into town again via Amtrak and a little hop from there. At the annual ICMA conference this past week, the International City and County Administrators Association or Management Association. And, this is a subject there, and I didn't miss the city council meeting, but I did miss the infrastructure committee meeting. I'm grateful that some folks were there instead. The quick answer for that committee is, it's my view, and I guess the city staff and I worked on trying to prioritize and harmonize what had become quite a lot of different committees that we thought could relate to each other better and provide better connection to the advisory bodies that also are driven by experts and volunteers in our community. And so as part of the retreat with City Council, I believe it was last year, not this year, the previous year, we put a proposal for a different set of committees forward. And part of it was to harmonize. And you'll note there's three council committees that are made up of three city council members each. There's the Infrastructure and Development Committee, which I'll describe in a little bit more detail in just a sec. So to me, that's the physical, natural capital, that kind of side of things. There's a Finance and Budget Committee, which you'd say could be the economic side. And then there's the Culture and Society Committee, which is a new committee, which is more the social side. And in my view, each of those are clear pillars for the concept of sustainability. And I guess the fourth pillar being a sustainable democracy. And that's the whole point here. So, that felt good to clearly distinguish committees that take on similar topics, much like housing, because you could come at it from a finance perspective or a culture and society perspective, but that the committees represented those aspects of sustainability. The other thing that we did and that council approved was aligning some of the advisory bodies with each of those parent committees so that those advisory bodies can give that advice more regularly and more directly to council. And so, for instance, you'll have the Parks, Recreation, Tree and Trails Advisory Board giving their recommendations to the Infrastructure Committee as sort of a group of volunteer experts as an advisory body to that committee. And that committee will take those recommendations and work with that group more closely than in the past. And then the final thing we did is kind of the restructure of city committees and advisory boards was to think of the short-term needs. So instead of something that had an immediate need and then sort of, waned over time, something like rules, which we occasionally need to come and refresh our rules, or something like the Discovery Road project, you know, required some community-based input from stakeholders, from those who understood active transportation. And as most listeners know, we galvanized, you know, kind of a direction through the support and the know-how of some of those members of the community who served on that task force. And so that's another thing you'll see more of these days, is really discrete task forces that take apart a specific challenge with a time, it's time bound. And then maybe there's another challenge that comes around that's slightly different, reconstitute and run another task force. And so all of that kind of that hangs together a little better than I think it did in the past, both as a group of committees and advisory bodies and task forces, but a little bit more clarity on what each group does. Now, to Carla's question, if you'll permit me, Tim, you know, the Infrastructure and Development Committee is really meant to do a couple things. One is it was sort of born by the former Housing Committee and the former Transportation Committee. And I think, to me, I saw some gaps in some of the other infrastructure, like sewer and water, that are really big topics right now and will be, because that's a huge primary focus of what the city delivers for our residents. And so it allowed the scope of that Transportation Committee to get bigger, and also for the Housing Committee to kind of be integrated into development, which is really our wheelhouse, you know, the infrastructure piece of development. The other thing is that I'm literally looking at a interlocal agreement with the county on how we work together multi-jurisdictionally on housing. So my personal view is, why replicate a committee where we work stronger with the county to do the same task through the Housing Task Force and the Joint Oversight Board? And so a slight tweak of that setup will be a place where we can have that same conversation with providers or advocates and advance housing more collaboratively with the county. And so I think another housing committee with the city is a little duplicative. Now, an infrastructure committee, though, is not duplicative, because that's really a core function of the city. And so when we talk about that, for instance, the Evans Vista property, that's a place where that committee's been able to weigh in, help advise and orient, you know, how we're going to get to success on that project. So that's a long answer to a very short question, Carla, and it's probably not comprehensive, but it's a bit of a start.
Well, it's a complex question, and the first thing that popped into my mind is Evans Vista. What is that?
Yeah. So I'll go to the next question, because we had I had another one come in. Tim, I might need to forward it to you. I could do so right now, actually.
No, no.
From Julia, and Julia also asks about the same thing, really, but more detail. And I'll have to paraphrase her question, because she more wants to know, in this project we're calling Evans Vista, which is not yet a project, we're scoping this, how might this be more publicly owned? Because that the idea of more publicly owned housing seems to be, in her mind, a real path forward that speakers at a conference she's at are advocating for, and not just doing the infrastructure development. And it's a really good question. I think partly because, you know, I just want to be clear to listeners, we haven't pulled, you know, the decision on this yet. This is not a done deal. We're holding the property and for 90 days as we do due diligence, including with tribes for cultural and archaeological significance. When we're thinking about, due diligence with the granting agencies and what we're able to do, because the money that we put down for this is going to be, if it does go forward, from affordable housing infrastructure that we received money from Washington State Commerce. There's a lot that we still need to figure out here. And I think the idea of the city retaining ownership is not off the table. I think we had thought initially that we would ready this property and actually many others in that area for development, including building out, acquiring it and building out sewer infrastructure, which currently is not available on that 14-acre property. And then we would want to work with an affordable housing developer to produce the housing, build the housing. The city doesn't swing the hammer on that. That's not really our forte. But we can provide a requirement for, say, 50 to 80% of the annual median income for housing and make it affordable housing. And I would say, you know, it's 14 acres, eight of which are about, you know, are developable. You know, there's an opportunity to do more than just, you know, the 50 to 80% AMI. There's an opportunity to think about workforce housing and even market rate housing on a site like that, that could be, you know, quite a success for many different levels of affordability and even market rate. So, you know, I think, Julia, we'll take that on board, that the possibly the city retaining ownership is a way for us to move forward. But, you know, the project has to pencil out for a developer. And so we're trying to juggle a number of things. And of course, we need to start working with people to envision what this might look like before we ask council to make a decision on whether or not to move forward.
Well, you brought up infrastructure, and well, evidently we have both been on long train rides recently. And I find that a great time to thank, frankly, yeah. And that happened to me on my train ride. Mm-hmm. And, that thought went to these projects that people in your position and you, of course, work on that are naturally fraught. I mean, there are certain city projects that are naturally controversial or will raise a lot of comment from the public. And there are those, I'm sure, that are just one of the hundreds of decisions that you and your department heads make every day on a routine basis just to keep the wheels on the city of Port Townsend. Have you ever made a decision that you thought was just a routine nuts and bolts decision to the city of Port Townsend that has turned out to be controversial or generated a lot of response that you didn't anticipate?
Well, I should have something ready because I'm blanking, but I will say, you know, controversial is in the eye of the beholder. I had a fun, a fun exchange with my team when I was on that train ride where they said, oh, we've gotten some Facebook comments, and the team does such a great job keeping across what comes in for citizen concerns, which you can do on our website. I've said many times, right on our home page on cityofpt.us, you can click, you know, report a concern, whether it be a pothole, a deer, or a water pipe that's burst. You know, we'll triage that and get to the immediate stuff quite quickly. The team's just awesome at that. But I was having an exchange with some of the folks in the team and lovingly about how a couple of comments came through about a particular issue. And it did kind of ignite should we respond to this immediately? And I love that instinct. However, you know, two or three people expressing concern is probably below my threshold of controversial, because, you know, you could be in a bar in a coffee shop and there are far more controversial issues that come up just between friends, you know, about in conversation. So, you know, I would say, you know, the example du jour recently is probably something that's over that threshold. And I did anticipate, so it doesn't answer your question well, but, you know, the replacement or the project around Poplars on Sims Way, the gateway, you know, we suspected that would be hard for people to swallow, and it still is. And I think we've got a lot of work to do there. But, you know, the way I see that is as long as everyone's working off the same information, and I think that's where we go wrong oftentimes, then, you know, those opinions are basically expressions of how much a community cares about where they live. And instead of, you know, getting on the back foot and trying to defend the project and all that, it just makes me understand that how we can engage everybody fairly and, you know, productively, if we can channel that energy to a better outcome, then that's what, you know, civil discourse is all about. So, you know, even the small controversies, when someone gets riled up, you know, provided you're relatively respectful in your exchange with the city, I mean, there is a threshold there, which I'll just, you know, not respond, but, you know, that energy is worth something and contributing to our common cause. What gets me down, however, is when there seems to be only a single sole interest. And I think part of what the city is, and I said this at a conference a couple of weeks ago, virtually, you know, the city is the arbiter of the common good. And so one, you know, we all give a little bit to live in society, and hopefully we all get a little bit. And if you're community minded, there is a place for you at the table for decision making for sure. If you're individually minded, it's harder to justify, because then there might be 95 different directions in this town for where we should go. And somehow that has to be worked out. So I invite, you know, maybe not controversy, but I certainly invite opinions and perspectives, much like what Julia said about, publicly owned housing. I mean, that's not a direction that we would probably normally go, but it adds to the dialogue and it gives us something to think about.
Well, just the fact that you're here every Thursday gives much credibility to that sentiment, frankly.
Hopefully.
Moving on to another subject, and I don't remember. I have the, of course, we can talk for days about the pros and cons of Facebook as it comes to, you know, in different projects here. And I don't remember where I saw it. It may have been the city Facebook page, but it concerned the changing of the parking signs to 24 hours. And, you know, I was surprised in the time that I've lived here. I've never noticed that. This sounds like the swallows are turning to Capistrano. This is something that you do every year. And why is that? What is the purpose?
It's good because, again, this shows if we tell the story of what we do routinely better, then people understand what we do and why. And, you know, I'm not trying to put a target up for the city here, but, you know, we could always get better about how we communicate and how we tell a story, provided people might be listening. So I'm glad you were listening, and I'm glad that that Facebook post, because it was a Facebook post, and it was a great picture of Rafe, actually, our public works team, putting up, changing those signs. And what happens during the typical summer here is that, you know, parking is more and more high demand. Obviously, we have more people visiting during that time of year. And so we limit that parking to 2 and 4 hours. And so right outside where I'm looking right now, just last week, I believe that said 4 hours right next to Memorial Field. Now, I've got lots of thoughts about parking. And I know that talk about an issue that can kind of rile everybody up with 9,500 different opinions. That's definitely one of them. But, you know, with 1,200 parking spaces downtown, you know, to me, I've always been clear, it's how we manage that that matters. It's not whether or not the city should afford or build a giant parking garage on the waterfront or, you know, other huge investments. It's really about how we get the outcomes we want. And one of those outcomes in the summertime is higher turnover. You know, someone like me, although I did ride a bike to work today, I could typically park across the street from where I'm, you know, standing now in the office and do so for a good period of time. And I've heard quite clearly from business owners, and I respect this, that people who like me who work in a building who really don't provide anything but, we're not. I did go out for lunch today, so I did shop a little bit, but. You know, we want to make sure if one of the outcomes is turnover in retail and businesses, that those spaces can be available for those who are kind of moving through. So hence a 2 or 4 hour parking limit when there's a more demand. And now that we're kind of into the, you know, winter or fall season here, that's not the case. And it's not quite as much of a requirement. So those signs can be turned back to 24 hours. But look, let me just tell you, we're this isn't like a forever strategy. You know, this is something that, like with deer and like with other things that I know I get emails about, you know, it was hot on our list before the pandemic. And we've had to do quite a lot of triage and we're still digging our way out. And those issues will need progress. You know, parking is something that we need to dig into with our residents, with our business community, with advocates. Same thing with deer. We actually need to make progress there at some point. So hopefully that's enough on parking there, Tim, unless you've got another one.
No. You opened the deer door. I won't walk through it, but I will walk through this one. And again, I'm not sure where I saw this information, but I think there was a bit of a leak or a problem at the sewage treatment plant recently. And, you know, frankly, I have a bit of an unhealthy interest in sewage treatment. I've visited sewage treatment plants at every place I've ever lived. I found that people that work there are happy for the company. The one thing about Port Townsend sewage treatment, it's not a million years old as it's much of the other infrastructure here in town. What happened? What needs to be done?
Yeah, no, that's great. That's a great question. And being out of town, you know, and also our public works director, Steve King, is finally taking a bit of a break this week. So he's out of town as well. So when I got word from the team that that there was a leak or actually a crack in the pipe, you know, I gathered more information and the team sent me some great photos. I wish I could show for all the listeners about how they waited for low tide and got in there and plugged the concern. So, you know, mortar mix is good enough and staff time to fix that. It's probably the fourth or fifth time, at least Bliss, who's the manager down there, says it's probably fourth or fifth time these types of repairs had to be done on the outfall. The break was about 50 feet out from shore, hence having to do the work around the tides. But I think what the public should know, there was a no swim notice for some time there because of the lack of dilution. But that is treated wastewater. So that's not raw sewage or anything that is contaminated. It is simply the very high class water that our treatment plant has won awards for 22, 23 straight years. And so, you know, it's out of an abundance of caution that no swim order was provided. But this does illustrate what do we need to do. It's like our water pipe, you know, it's about 100 years old. A lot of our water line, as we've talked about, and a lot of our sewer pipes are almost equally as old. And so, you know, what do we need to do and where do we need to prioritize investment over the next several years? Our comprehensive sewage plan or sewer plan, the most recent version is 2020. So a couple of decades later, we're going to double down this coming year. It's in our work plan to think holistically about what our comprehensive sewer plan and capital program needs to be. And previous, you know, to me arriving, we had talked about the outfall as a major project. So it's a multi-million dollar rebuild with some, you know, some concerns around that we've heard from the public around, you know, disturbance of eelgrass beds. And I mean, it's a complicated project. We're thinking about fish. So, you know, this is another thing we need to concentrate on this coming year when we develop that plan to say, you know, how do we advance a project like that that keeps us from having to plug the pipe, but also prevents unnecessary damage to that fragile ecosystem. So, you know, and honestly, the end pipe is where, you know, people pay a lot of attention, but, you know, we have sewer pipes all over the place, right? We have, you know, dozens of miles of sewer pipes. So we need to think about things far before they break and actually invest in them. And I think historically we found it really challenging. We're catching up on water and sewer and streets for decades of, you know, not sufficient maintenance.
A big job to be sure, and one of the more important jobs that we have, along with water. And I know that you are currently in the process of working with the mill on that one. I think you spoke about this with Phil. So, do you have any idea of when that draft agreement will be available?
Yeah, I mean we're bound by a timeline that's the end of this year, you know? And so we've been discussing with mill leadership the last several weeks, every week, on advancing the agreement and the negotiations. So, you know, it's my aim that by the end of this year, we've got something in place. Now we're having to work really hard and fast on that. It's incredibly important that there's a very clear time when the public can have a look at what this looks like. And this month, we're hoping to bring something forward in a public session. It might be as early as mid-October, probably not earlier than that, but, you know, mid-October, when we can start having a discussion about the principles and the direction that we want to go with the mill. And so I would encourage anybody who drinks water to pay attention, because it matters for all of us. You know, we'll start that community conversation around the agreement and really just a matter of weeks, with an aim to get it done by the end of the year. Now, I should say we've started the conversation quite early with white papers and a couple public events for the Historical Society and the mill, and, you know, the education around the water line and its history, it's a long history since 1927, has been undertaken. But we're needing to now talk specifically about the agreement, what it entails, the direction that we're recommending council to go. And as you can imagine, just like I'm sure the mill's thinking, you know, before you have some degree of agreement from your board or your council, Those negotiations are quite sensitive. And that's why we've been doing that without direct public involvement to date. There is a time, however, for very direct public feedback. And I'm really looking forward to that part of this.
And I am looking forward to it also, Mr. John Morrow. And you have been listening to Port Townsend City Manager John Morrow talking about all the various, the juggling act that goes on to keep a city like Port Townsend alive and vibrant. We did. There'd be plenty of reasons to take another long train ride, Mr. Morrow. And you know, frankly, I think that when you do that, instead of flying over it, you see so many of the problems that we talk about are not unique to us. You see the homelessness along the railroad lines. You see that, like in the city that I went to, which was Morro Bay, California, where they had the outdoor dining at the expense of parking. These are issues that affect every municipality, and I'm glad we have people to grapple with them.
Well, thanks, Tim. And I have to say, I mean, being with hundreds and hundreds of city managers from around the country and actually the world this past week, I was really impressed with the conference. I was surprised it was on, but it was a mandatory requirement for vaccination, for masks. We were tested. It was kind of above and beyond CDC, guidelines. The idea exchange was extraordinary. It was kind of comforting because there, you know, we're all grappling, big and small cities, left and right, blue and red, rural and urban, with similar problems. And there's so much more common ground that binds us together than difference. So that's, somehow validating about the human condition.
It is indeed. I'll end with one little bit of knowledge that may mean nothing to anybody but myself. And that is that I walked into a grocery store in Morro Bay after that train ride on the day that somebody bought the winning $700 million lottery ticket. I bought an avocado. But I've always been of the opinion that, playing the lot, your chances of winning the lottery are about the same whether you play or not. But if I had won, Port Townsend would immediately have a monorail. So, keep that in mind, Mr. Morrow.
There's a permitting path, but I hope the avocado was pleasant. I hear they grow them well down there.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week.
Sounds great, Tim. Thanks, everybody.
Okay.